From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the practice of poverty medicine. Dr. David Hilfiker's patients are homeless men in Washington, D.C. Even the simplest medical prescriptions like bed rest and a healthy diet are useless for people who have no homes or food. Dr. Hilfiker says his work with the homeless has more in common with third world medicine than with what we think of as modern medicine. Also today, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Fading Smile, a memoir by Peter Davison, poetry editor of The Atlantic Monthly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Coast Guard reports record numbers of refugees continue to leave Cuba. More than 2,500 were pulled from makeshift rafts and boats in the Florida Straits yesterday, and more than 1,200 have been picked up today. They're being taken to the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Defense Secretary William Perry says the administration is seeking alternatives to Guantanamo.
There is the possibility of expanding Guantanamo further. There's also the possibility of moving a number of the refugees into Panama when the new government becomes established there. So there are many alternatives not yet exploited.
The exodus has grown despite President Clinton's announcement that all Cubans intercepted at sea will be taken to Guantanamo base. Lawyers have been arguing over whether the NAACP must reinstate former executive director Benjamin Chavis. A superior court judge in Washington, D.C. is to rule tomorrow on whether Chavis will get an injunction barring the group from firing him. Chavis says his ouster violated the civil rights group's rules and could damage his reputation. The NAACP argues Chavis abandoned his responsibilities by agreeing to settle a sex discrimination complaint without telling the board of directors. They argue restoring him could hurt fundraising. Police say they suspect that 10 inmates who escaped from a prison in Detroit may have been aided by guards at the facility. So far, 7 of the escapees have been recaptured. Don Gagne reports.
With the apprehension of 2 of the inmates this afternoon, 3 are still on the loose. One of them is a convicted murderer, and police say all should be considered dangerous. One escapee was found dead yesterday in a Detroit alley, possibly of a drug overdose. Detroit Police Chief Isaiah McKinnon has said the investigation into how the inmates managed to escape has raised some questions about the behavior of some guards at the prison. 2 guards have been questioned. Chief McKinnon says charges could be forthcoming. 4 prison employees have been suspended with pay pending the outcome of the investigation. The escape has also renewed complaints about prison overcrowding and the type of prisoner housed in the medium security facility. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A Georgia teacher has been suspended for not obeying a state law that requires a moment of silence in state schools. American government teacher Brian Bowne instead led his class in a discussion of the new law during the quiet time yesterday. Bowne told the principal of Gwinnett County Schools today that he would not comply with the law because it violates his conscience and his beliefs. He also says he believes it's unconstitutional. Bowne has been suspended with pay. A hearing has been scheduled on whether he should be fired. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 26 points at 3,777. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up 5 points at 748. This is NPR. Senate Republicans say they want to negotiate with President Clinton and Senate Democrats on the crime bill. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole says this would avoid a procedural point that could open the legislation to more amendments. Similar action in the House led to the crime bill's approval last weekend. Dole accuses the White House of ignoring Senate Republicans, and he says it's clear their votes are needed to pass the legislation. Aid workers in Zaire are struggling to cope with tens of thousands of refugees who've just arrived from southwest Rwanda. Pressure on the Zairean town of Bukavu has eased a bit as the Hutu refugees move to a new camp on the outskirts of town. The BBC's Roger Hearing has more from Bukavu.
The border problem seems to have been solved, at least for the moment. But aid workers are now confronting the logistics of moving tens of thousands of people and setting up a camp in which they can live. The campsite at Hongo, which can take up to 80,000 refugees, is still no more than a muddy field. Tents and food have not arrived, and the road to the camp is almost impassable due to the heavy rains of the last few days. There's also open hostility from the local people who've been farming the land, which has been designated as a camp. Mark Richardson of the aid agency CARE said preparations to receive the refugees had to be abandoned because aid workers were being threatened by the Zairians. The local authorities have agreed to provide security for the camp if the threats continue. The campsite itself has now been shifted 1 kilometre to allow local farmers to retain some of their crops. So far, there are around 4,000 people at the site and just over 100,000 at the other camps in the area.
Roger Hearing reporting. Firefighters say they'll have the biggest western wildfire contained by tomorrow. Crews are winning the battle against Washington State's Tyee Creek Fire, which has consumed 127,000 acres. The fire crews are taking advantage of cool weather and high humidity to put out a 43,000-acre fire called the Hatchery Complex Fire. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Hilfiker is a physician. Since 1983, his patients have been homeless men in Washington, D.C. For 5 years, he lived in Christ House, a 34-bed medical recovery shelter for homeless men too sick to be on the streets, yet not sick enough to be in the hospital. He lived with his wife and 3 children in the upper floor of the clinic. In 1990, he started Joseph's House, a medical residence for homeless men with AIDS. Dr. Hilfiker is about to return to work after a year-long hiatus. In his new memoir, Not All of Us Are Saints, he writes about what it's been like for a middle-class doctor to work with the poor. He's found that the simplest medical acts reveal the deepest social contradictions. Dr. Hilfiker started working with the homeless after 7 years as a family doctor in rural Minnesota. He moved to the inner city because he was overwhelmed by the pressures of being a country doctor.
I think the particulars, the fact that I'm more comfortable working in the city as opposed to the country, have to do with my particular personality and my particular call. I don't know that the work in the city is any more difficult or any easier than the work in the country. What was difficult for me as a country doctor was the reality that as an isolated rural physician, and our specialists were 110 miles away, as an isolated rural doctor, one has always to practice on the limits of one's competence. You find yourself putting in a pacemaker when you haven't done it or seen it in 2 years, taking care of heart attack patients that you have to take care of because there isn't a specialist around. Frankly, you're not up on all the latest stuff doing surgery when you've been trained nowhere near as much as a surgeon would be trained. So you're practicing always just kind of pushing the limits of your competence. And what that means is that there's opportunities for mistakes and real mistakes themselves that I found intolerable. The pressure was just too great for me. And I couldn't, after 7 years there, I just couldn't take it anymore and had to leave.
Was the decision to do inner city medicine part medical and part spiritual?
Both. We came to Washington, chose Washington because of a particular religious community here, the Church of the Savior, that we had heard about and which had a structure, had a congregation that we were very much interested in joining. So that there was that part to it. The decision to practice in the inner city came, as you say, very one part was just technical. I knew that in the inner city I'd be much closer to specialists, that I would be practicing much more clinic medicine, not anywhere near as much the high-tech hospital medicine that had been so difficult for me. So on one hand, it was sort of a technical issue. But on the other hand, and I couldn't, I'm much better at articulating it now, and I couldn't articulate it then. In some way, I knew that my own journey was involved in the life of people who'd been marginalized by our society, and that if I were to find the meaning in my own life that I was searching for, it was going to be through this work with people who'd been marginalized in the society.
You've been working with people who are homeless, and the house that you've worked in was for people too sick to be on the streets but not sick enough for a hospital. Right. What were the typical kinds of illnesses and medical conditions that came under that heading?
Well, the first house that we lived and worked in was Christ House, a infirmary for homeless men who, as you say, were too sick to be on the streets but didn't qualify for the hospital. And probably a third of our patients were people who were discharged from the hospital. and needed to recuperate people who had an operation, gallbladder removed or stomach surgery, or had a leg operated on and needed to recuperate, needed to rest for 2 weeks. And the shelters in Washington, at least, are not places that you can recuperate very well, so they would come to us. Another group of people were people with illnesses that were not quite bad enough to get them in the hospital in the first place, but they what they needed was a home to lie down in. People with pneumonia, people with severe colds, people with phlebitis, so that their legs were all swollen up. And then there were other people who needed to be brought in for control of sort of temporary exacerbation of their medical conditions, people whose diabetes was out of control, people who high blood pressure was out of control and needed a place to stay and be quiet for a couple of days or a couple of weeks while their medical condition was taken care of.
I guess homeless shelters aren't the greatest place for healing.
Well, they certainly aren't. Most of them are crowded. Almost all of them, at least in Washington, the men's shelters anyway, you have to leave at 7 o'clock in the morning and you can't get back in until 7 in the evening. So you're on the street in whatever weather it is, at least 12 hours a day. And if you've got swollen legs from a heart condition, you know, you can't keep them up. You can't rest your back during the day if you're in a shelter because you've got to be out on the streets.
You've been practicing what you describe as poverty medicine, which you describe as an area of specialization that isn't yet recognized as such. How would you describe poverty medicine?
Well, I guess the best description of it is a willingness and an attempt to be sensitive to the needs of people coming from the backgrounds that they come from. For instance, if I, as a doctor, want to take care of a person with back pain, most often the prescription is for bed rest. And if I tell a person to go home and to buy a heating pad and to find somebody to take care of him for 3 or 4 days, if that person is living in a shelter, my advice is meaningless. Poverty medicine is trying to be sensitive to those realities in people's lives and adapting what we do to the people's situation. If a person has an infection and needs an antibiotic and I have a choice between two antibiotics, one of which is a little bit better and costs $180 for a 10-day prescription and the other is maybe not quite as good an antibiotic but only costs $7, you know, the doctor in me wants to prescribe the absolute best antibiotic. But if I do, the person is not going to fill it. He won't tell me that ordinarily because he's embarrassed, but he's not going to fill that prescription when he finds out how much it costs. So I need to be sensitive always to the financial issues in the person's life, to the social issues in the person's life.
So say you prescribe the $7 instead of the $180 antibiotic, and the person you're prescribing it for is homeless and has no money at all. How do they get the $7 for the antibiotics?
Well, that's a very good question. In many cases, they don't. So that we end up, we have a pharmacy of our own where we have medications donated that are almost out of date from other physicians' office. There's a consortium of pharmaceutical companies that donate medications to us. And in fact, we end up giving, I would say, for homeless patients, almost all of our medications are given to patients, which brings up its own problems. For instance, the kinds of samples that are available to doctors are generally the latest medications, and they will be available for 3 or 4 months, and then another medication will be available. So I find myself switching high blood pressure medications on patients every 4, 5, 6 months because I don't have the medication I started the person on. That's not good medicine, but that's a reality in my practice.
Some of the typical medical problems you saw at the infirmary for the homeless that you worked at included frostbite, feet infections, phlebitis, tuberculosis, AIDS. But occasionally you'd come across some really unusual problems. Once a woman came to the clinic, she said she had something stuck in her vagina, which turned out to be a plastic bag of heroin.
Right.
That she had stashed there, obviously, to hide it. And that put you in a really difficult ethical dilemma. Would you explain what the dilemma was for you?
Yeah. you know, the person, she came in, and when we were in the exam room, she said that she had something stuck there. She, of course, that's all she said was it was stuck down there. I was sort of used to that situation. People would, women would occasionally come in with a condom lodged high in the vagina or a sanitary napkin, a tampon. And so I just took it out and was shocked to find out that it was a small plastic bag filled with powder, which I assumed was heroin. We had lawyers working down the hall from the building, and so I kind of called them and asked them what my responsibility was, and they said, well, technically, I was, if I gave the drug, whatever it was, back to her, I'd be guilty of distribution of controlled substances and would be, you know, liable to prosecution. I went in, back into the room, and told her that, and her face got very pale and panicked. She literally went down on her knees and said, if you don't give me back, they will kill me. What the situation was, apparently, is that she was acting as a person who held the drug during a transaction, and that there was a lot of money involved in this particular transaction. And according to her, and I've heard this from others, she would have possibly been killed had she not been able to come up with the drug that she was supposed to be holding. I didn't know what to do, and talked to a partner of mine, and ultimately, flying by the seat of my pants, gave the package back to her. We got to talking, and she talked about her own addiction and how she wanted to kick the habit. She promised she would come back in perhaps that afternoon to get her in a treatment program. She left, and that was the last I saw her.
My guest is Dr. David Hilfiker, and his new memoir, Not All of Us Are Saints, is about his work at an infirmary for the homeless in Washington, D.C., and he was previously a doctor in rural Minnesota. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
Okay, this is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. David Hilfiker. He's a physician at Medical Shelters for the Homeless. You write in your book that when you first entered the universe of visible suffering, you assumed that provoking political change when it came to medicine for the poor was just a matter of getting the ordinary, everyday people around you to understand what was happening. Then there would be an outpouring of money and concern for the welfare of the poor. But then you realized that homelessness had become in some way an accepted, tolerable evil, and compassion had shut down. But then you started having your own problems with your patients, too. And you write that far from being the salt of the earth, some of your patients just taught you how difficult it can be to care for the poor.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the difficulties you encountered?
Those were and remain very painful times for me. I came to Washington really believing that the poor had been oppressed, that the poor were victims of social structures, and that if, you know, we provided the kinds of structures, the kinds of help that people needed, that they would, by and large, you know, be able to take advantage of those things and would be able to flourish. And in some cases that was true, but in many, many cases, I found out that that people made the kinds of choices, made stupid decisions that often kept them in those cycles. For instance, you know, addictions is sort of the clearest example, where you have people who will refuse to go in a treatment program because of one reason or another, will come out of the treatment program and start using again. And you say, gee, why can't this person just, you know, do the things that are necessary to keep him sober? An example that was even more painful was to see the cycles of child abuse, to see a young child. We actually had one child that, it's happened several times, but there's one that I remember in particular, a young girl that I knew about age 10 or 11 when I first came to the clinic, who was a child who was abused in many different ways. Her mother was an addict, and she had been passed around from relative to relative and had never had the kind of home that a child needs, the kind of love that a person needs. She became pregnant at 13, had delivered her baby by the time before she turned 14. And I then watched her over the next year or two as she became an abusing mother herself, someone who used physical punishment very inappropriately in her young child, a person who didn't bring her kids in for the appropriate immunizations and medical care. The cycle of poverty was simply much deeper than I had realized, and the oppressive structures had created broken people, people who couldn't be healed by just giving them medications or just giving them what they needed at the minute.
You write, when I find that I cannot love my patients or even serve them without resentment, I invariably wonder what's wrong with me. Why don't I, like Mother Teresa, see the face of Jesus in the poor? How would you get through personal crises like that?
Well, you know, there is certain religious circles that I travel in, there's a kind of a romanticism about the poor, stemming, I think, probably from, at least recently, from liberation theology, this notion that if we give ourselves over to the poor, that they will be our saviors. They'll lead us to our own liberation. And that's been, there is a real truth in that perception about the spiritual importance of our identification with the poor. But that romanticization is a gross oversimplification of the realities of what poverty means. Part of getting through that situation is to stop kidding ourselves with these romantic ideas and to be very clear about what the nature of poverty is, the damage that poverty often does to the souls of people, to render them incapable of being grateful for things. The other side of the coin is the reality that many of the people I take care of who are emotionally and in many cases physically broken have a spiritual wholeness and a spiritual strength that is overwhelming to me. For 3 years from 1990 to 1993, I lived in a home with 11 men who were homeless and who had AIDS. And, you know, most of those men had gotten their AIDS from drug addiction. Many of them were still actively addicted when they came to the house. And to see people who had been broken in those kinds of ways, and yet to see their faith in God, to see their courage in the face of a real hopelessness, to see their attempts to reestablish connections with their families, to feel their honesty with me. They were people who didn't pull punches. There was a kind of a spiritual strength and a beauty there that I had not experienced other places. So, you know, some parts of the work are enormously frustrating. I tear my hair out and I get angry at myself for my inability to be more compassionate. And at the same time, there are these moments of grace in which one feels one is in the presence of God.
During the years that you worked at Christ House, this was a clinic for 34 homeless people.
Yes.
And you and some of the other medical staff lived in apartments on the third and fourth story. The
right.
Patients were in the first and second stories. So you, your wife, and your three kids lived upstairs in this clinic. And you said that you were separated from the patients by locks and by coded elevators. You'd have
right.
to know the code to get the elevator to the two floors that the medical staff lived on. Was that a comfortable arrangement for you?
Well, it was an arrangement that No, I guess we couldn't say it was comfortable. It was, on the one hand, it was uncomfortable because it brought us much closer to the poor than, you know, and whenever one, as a middle-class person, puts oneself in juxtaposition to the poor, all the contradictions of society kind of pop out at you, and so you're forced to look at the contradictions of society. And so on the one hand, it was uncomfortable from that point of view. On the other hand, we were perpetuating a lot of that separation by the fact that we were separating ourselves from the men who lived downstairs, by the fact that we still lived in very middle-class apartments, had lots of things that they would never ever dream of having. So it was one of those compromises that we made that sort of didn't, at least from one way of looking at it, didn't leave you comfortable on either end.
In 1990, you moved out of Christ House and created Joseph's House, a single-family house in which you lived there with your family, and then you invited 11 homeless men who had AIDS to live out their days in the house, too. So it was part your home, it was part hospice. What was your reason for leaving Christ House and developing Joseph's House?
Well, it really had to do, at least partly, with one of the questions you asked earlier, whether the level of separation from the men wasn't difficult. It was. We wanted to have more equal relationships with the people that we lived with. We wanted not to have locks and codes in between us and them. We wanted to enter into family relationships with the men. And that, by the nature of Christ House, the fact that we were taking in men only temporarily, was not possible there. The kinds of structure that we had at Christ House were necessary there, but we wanted something in which we were living more closely with people. At the same time, the needs of homeless men with AIDS were becoming overwhelming, and because we were a temporary place at Christ House, we had to ask everybody eventually with AIDS to leave, and where were they supposed to go? So we wanted to have a place where people could, where we didn't have to send them away, where we really could develop family. It was also one of the realities that I had struggled with all of the then 7 years in practice, was that I and my family remained sort of firmly in the middle class with all the privileges, the money, the security that we had, while all of my patients had none of those things. I went home to a comfortable home. They went home to places that were often surrounded by violence, where there wasn't enough food, where the conditions weren't very good. And frankly, that kind of tension was just very difficult for me and for my wife, Maria. So we wanted to at least see whether it would be possible to live as family and to see whether, if we lived in a situation where we both went home to the same place, where some of the walls between us could be broken.
So was it possible?
Yes. Surprisingly, it was very difficult. Ultimately, I had to leave because of my own emotional struggles that I've had all my life. But the level of community, the kinds of trust that evolved, the relationships that my kids had with the men, it was the most intense experience. My wife and I have lived in various kinds of community all of our married lives, but those 3 years were the most intense and meaningful community we've ever been a part of.
Dr. David Hilfiker is the author of the new memoir, Not All of Us Are Saints. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dr. Hilfiker will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, not all of us are saints. We continue our conversation with physician David Hilfiker, author of a new memoir about his work treating homeless men in medical recovery shelters. Dr. Hilfiker has worked with the poor for a decade, but sometimes he wrestles with doubts and wonders why he can't be like Mother Teresa and always see the face of Jesus in the poor. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews the new memoir by Peter Davison, poetry editor for The Atlantic Monthly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. More than 1,200 Cubans trying to get to the United States have already been picked up by the Coast Guard in the Florida Straits. Coast Guard Petty Officer Jeff Hall says the interdiction is also, in part, a rescue operation.
The boats are mostly small. With the choppy Florida Straits, waves usually wash over the sides and over the bow, which flood the boats and swamp them, so they are always bailing water out. It's very unsafe. They also cross on makeshift rafts made of inner tubes and pieces of wood, or maybe 55-gallon drums with pieces of wood on top of them.
The Cubans are being taken to the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Defense Secretary William Perry says there is very little chance those who risk their lives to flee their homeland by sea will ever achieve their goal of getting to the United States. Several big business groups are launching attacks on Democratic health care reform bills in Congress. A coalition of a dozen businesses has taken out ads in major newspapers today. It urges amendments to the health care bills proposed by Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt. The coalition says both bills would raise taxes on firms with workers in more than one state, and it claims states would be allowed to force workers to join state health care systems. Senate work on health care has been put off for work on the revised crime bill. Japan's prime minister arrived in the Philippines today, where he began his first leg of an Asian tour. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports from Tokyo.
Besides the Philippines, Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama will visit Vietnam, Malaysia, and Singapore. Part of his mission is to reassure these countries that Japan's foreign policy has not changed despite the frequent turnover in government. Murayama is Japan's third prime minister in a year. He'll also use the trip to broaden economic ties with the region. For the past several years, Japanese exports to Southeast Asian nations have been growing by an annual average of more than 9%. And Murayama will try to repair some of the political damage done by his former environment minister recently. The minister said Japan did not lead a war of aggression during World War II, setting off a storm of protest in the region. In Tokyo, I'm Marjorie Sun.
Claimants who want Exxon to pay them $15 billion for the Valdez oil spill say they just want $1 from Captain Joseph Hazelwood. A lawyer for the plaintiff says Hazelwood has had enough. Hazelwood's lawyer says his client shouldn't have to pay anything. Hazelwood was in charge of the Valdez ship when it hit a reef in Alaska's Prince William Sound 5 years ago. 11 million gallons of crude oil spilled into the water. It is the nation's worst oil spill. The jury in the case has already ruled Exxon and Hazelwood were reckless in causing this accident. It awarded the plaintiffs nearly $290 million in compensatory damage. The jury is now deciding punitive damages. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 24 points to end the day at 3,775. This is NPR. Delta Airlines has hired AT&T as an outside contractor to run many of its computer systems. The airline is hoping to cut costs by tapping the research and development resources at AT&T. Bruce Dorton with Peach State Public Radio reports.
The $2.8 billion deal means Delta has become the first major airline to hand much of its information technology processes to an outside firm. Delta spokesman Bobby Harper says the venture will be profitable to both companies.
AT&T and their Global Information Solutions and Delta have signed an agreement in principle to form this joint venture company that will not only provide information technology products to Delta, but also other customers in the travel and transportation industry. So it's a twofold benefit to Delta. We'll save money and we'll make money.
The AT&T Delta venture will be based in Atlanta and employ 1,200 current Delta workers. It will sell computing and communication services to other transportation and travel companies, but will not provide reservation systems. Delta Chairman Ron Allen is quoted as saying, "This new deal is part of the airline's plan to return to profitability." For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
The United Nations is speeding up its investigation of mass killings in Rwanda. A UN spokeswoman says Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has asked a panel to finish its investigation in 4 months. The committee is trying to do it in 3. The Secretary General could recommend the creation of an international tribunal to try aggressors. A Chinese news agency reports that Hurricane Fred has claimed the lives of at least 700 people. The storm has roared through China's eastern Zhejiang province. At least 800,000 homes have been badly damaged or destroyed, and nearly 600 miles of dikes have been destroyed. Large areas of cropland are damaged. Landslides have blocked highways. Torrential rain is cutting off power. The report says 90,000 businesses have closed. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. David Hilfiker. In his new memoir, Not All of Us Are Saints, he writes about practicing what he describes as poverty medicine. For 5 years, he worked and lived in Christ House, a medical shelter for homeless men. Then in 1990, he created Joseph's House, a medical residence for homeless men with AIDS, where Dr. Hilfiker lived with his wife and 3 children. You took a sabbatical, I guess for about a year, from your work with poverty medicine.
Yes.
And went to live in Finland, I think it was.
Yes.
Where your wife is from. And now you're coming back. You're back in Washington, D.C., and you're about to start practicing poverty medicine again and about to move into Joseph's House again?
No, we've decided not to move back in. There are 3 of us now. My 2 girls are off on their own. It turned out that for each of us, for my son, for my wife, and for myself, it was not the right time to move back into Joseph's House. My son, when we first moved to Joseph's House, was young enough to be the mascot. He's now 15, and we noticed during the last year that we were at Christ House, at Joseph's House, that there was starting to be competition between him and the men. He was of an age in which, if he were on the streets, he would in fact be competition for the men. And their expectations of what a young boy ought to be like were not things that I wanted. I mean, their ideas about child rearing, for instance, were very different from mine. And so there were conflicts. And we have felt all along that if ever we got to a situation where our calling, our vocation, interfered with our children's life in a negative way, that we would not do that. And so it was fairly clear that it was not a good time for us, for Kai, to return to Joseph's House. And so we now have our own apartment not far from Joseph's House. For my wife, she has started her own, 7-8 years ago, she started her own school, working with people who are the same kinds of folks that I work with in the clinic. And while she loved the men at Joseph's House and loved living there, it was simply too much to come home from school full day there, and then to be on duty at Joseph's House. And so it didn't seem right for her to live there. For myself, I've struggled all my life with depression, and it just got to be too much for me at the end. The combination of my own depression and the stresses of living in the house, at least for now, are too much. So for each of us, it seemed best that we move out, have some time just as a family, and try to do our work a little bit more from the outside. So no, we'll not be returning to live in the house.
Do you think depression had anything to do with you wanting to become a doctor?
Oh, I think so. I didn't know at that point. I only discovered that I've been struggled with it ever since college, but didn't recognize it until about 10 years ago when I took my first sabbatical from my practice in rural medicine. And depression is a terrible illness to have to struggle with. One of the gifts of depression, however, is a sensitivity to the suffering of others. And I'm very sensitive to the suffering of others. And so, yes, it's the thing that my depression as, and I would get rid of it in an instant if I had the choice. Nevertheless, it gives me the kind of sensitivity that patients recognize that I can feel what they are going through. And so my relationships, I think I can offer to my patients something that they're very grateful for.
Do you take any kind of pills for your depression?
I do now.
You do?
Mm-hmm. Have for 4 or 5 years.
And that helps you?
It helps. It's not a perfect solution.
And it doesn't take away your calling?
No. No, I think the calling would be the same anyway. I mean, you know, all this talk about Prozac and the happy pills, I don't happen to take Prozac, but all this talk about Prozac and the happy pills obscures the fact that for people who have clinical depression, the pills are not happy pills. What they do is they provide a floor beneath which you don't sink. When I am on the medication, I feel like I think a normal person feels. I don't feel high. I don't feel, you know, happy or exuberant. I feel like this is sort of how life is supposed to be. So, no, in fact, I don't feel like any of my sensitivity is gone. It makes the calling more possible because I don't have those deep, deep troughs of depression.
My guest is Dr. David Hilfiker. His new memoir about his work with the poor is called Not All of Us Are Saints. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. David Hilfiker. He works with homeless men in Washington, D.C. You've compared poverty medicine to third world medicine.
Yes.
How is what you're doing similar to what doctors do in the third world?
In many cases, for people who do not have coverage, referring them to specialists, referring them to the kinds of diagnostic tests that would be that are available for most other people here isn't possible because they don't have the finances to pay for it. And as a clinic, we can't afford to pay for it for them. So one of the ways in which it's like third world medicine is that we often are dealing with limitations of resources, both diagnostic resources and medications. And other kinds of therapy that you find in the third world. For instance, it's quite difficult for me to refer a person for physical medicine, for physical therapy. There simply aren't places that take people who can't pay. There are many medications which are simply we can't get given to us and are too expensive for our patients to afford. So those kinds of limitations are like third world medicine. The other way, another way in which it's like third world medicine is that in the third world, preventive programs and social programs are much more important, really, than individual doctor confrontations. You know, it's like the old example, if you can clean up the water, you're going to save a whole lot more lives than if you get people to see the doctor. The dirty water's the thing that's causing the problem. Well, in the inner cities, that same kind of thing is true. If we could deal with the problems of drug addiction, alcohol addiction, child abuse, those would solve many, many, many more medical problems than I'm going to ever solve. So, as a private doctor, so as a clinic, we need to be working on those kinds of social issues at least as much as we work on, the individual doctor interaction. So our clinic does lots of other kinds of things. In one sense, my role as a physician is one of the less important roles in our clinic.
One of the growing medical problems for the homeless now is tuberculosis, and this is an especially important problem because tuberculosis is contagious. So not only is the person with TB at risk, but the people who come in contact with them are at risk as well. How do you deal with it when someone who you see has tuberculosis?
You know, the tragedy of tuberculosis is that it is such an easy disease to treat.
And unless it's a bacteria that's resistant to antibiotics, which is sometimes the case now, right?
Well, that's true. But, I mean, I shouldn't say is, has been in the past, and it would have been possible for us to get rid of it completely during the 60s and 70s had we, you know, done the things that were necessary at the time. What is needed when once you know a person has tuberculosis, what happens is that the person is put in the hospital for 2 weeks and gets the appropriate 3 or 4 drug regimen to treat the illness. If the person is in the hospital for that period of time and gets the appropriate medications, the person isn't cured, but he's no longer contagious. And what you do when the person's in the hospital is you check the sputum, what he spits up, to make sure that the bacteria aren't there anymore. And then as long as the person will take the medication for the, you know, 9 to 12 to 15 months that is necessary, he's no longer contagious. Now, there are some exceptions to that. One is that you mentioned the drug-resistant to tuberculosis, and the other is people with AIDS who don't have the kinds of resistance to tuberculosis that the rest of us have, and so you've got to treat them much more intensively. The theory or the practice for those two groups, however, is the same. You continue to give them medicines. If they take their medicines, continue to take their medicines day by day over the 12-month period, they will not be contagious while they're being treated. The problem with homeless people and other poor people is that it's often very difficult for many different reasons for them to continue to take their medicines on a day-to-day basis for an entire year.
Mm-hmm. You've been working at places that have a religious component, you know, like Christ House mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Joseph's House. Your father was a clergyman in the Protestant Mainline Church, and right. You write that you left the church for 15 years as a young man. Then obviously you came back to it. Can I ask why you left and what brought you back?
I left because I didn't believe in God anymore. I had 2 good philosophy courses at Yale and came out an agnostic, and I couldn't get any good answers from my dad or anybody else, and so I didn't see any reason to stay in the church. And for the next, you know, 15, 17 years, I explored other kinds of spirituality, everything from psychedelic medications to Zen to transcendental meditation to, you know, you name it, and Mari and I probably tried it. What became apparent to us was that all of us are on spiritual journeys and all of us need to have spiritual grounding. It became, you know, clear to us as we went on that we were not going to find our spiritual basis in some kind of exotic foreign spirituality, but that both of us had been reared in the church and that was where we were going to find our homes. And so it's, for me, it's, I'm not a person who has had an easy time with spirituality. I struggle with my own faith and with my own belief in God, and I'm alternately angry and disbelieving in God. So it's not, I'm not a person who, you know, can say, well, I'm rock solid in my faith now. That's simply not true. But my work in inner city Washington, my work with people of poverty, my work with people who have AIDS, has provided me with a kind of faith, a kind of trust in other people and in relationships that is now really the center of my faith.
You took a year hiatus that's coming to a close.
Right.
You know, you felt burned out, and that's happened to you twice where
yes.
you've taken a leave. So this is the tail end of your leave, and you go back to work when?
I'm working some now at Joseph's House, and I'll be going back to work in the clinic in about a month.
You apprehensive?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I frankly don't know whether I can do it or not. This is a very pivotal time in my life, and I need to, you know, I'm sort of 2 strikes now, and I don't know whether I can do this kind of work or not. Again, that's primarily because of my own emotional limitations, and I'm going to be taking it very easy and kind of feeling it out to see whether I can continue to be a physician or whether I need to use my skills someplace else.
what are you going to be looking for to make this really important and difficult decision?
Well, the question for me has always been whether I can involve myself in my work and with people who are in need, and yet reserve enough of myself so that I don't burn out, so that I've got another life. And I've never been very good at, I'm always a person who kind of jumps into something with both feet. And I don't think I can do that. I need to hold myself back some. And the question is whether I can do that, whether it's possible to be a doctor that way, whether I can practice primary care frontline medicine with the kind of emotional limitations that I have. And I just need to remain very sensitive to my own, you know, emotional state, get feedback from my wife and the rest of my family and from my friends, and see whether this is something that I can do.
So if you draw the line, I bet you feel selfish, and if you don't draw the line, you burn out.
Well, that is the way I tend to be. That's a false dichotomy. My religious faith is that God does not call us to do things that are bad for us, and I'm not doing anybody a favor, by including my patients, by working in such a way that I am harried and tense and angry and, you know, impatient. I need to find a, if I'm to do this work, I need to find a way to limit myself so that I can, when I'm with my patients, I can offer myself completely to them, or else I'm not being fair to them. So, you know, we talk about it as being a dichotomy that if I, you know, you burn out or you're selfish, but that's a false way of looking at it. I need to find a way that I can offer myself and yet realize that I'm a limited person like everybody else.
Well, good luck to you. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been good to talk with you.
Dr. David Hilfiker is the author of the new memoir, Not All of Us Are Saints. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's happening with the crime bill on Capitol Hill?
Hi, Terry. Elizabeth Arnold will report on the progress of the bill in the Senate. It has passed the House already. I'll talk with the police chief of Hartford, Connecticut, who's pretty happy with the provisions of the crime bill. Any money coming his way basically would help. I'll also speak with the sheriff of Johnson County, Missouri, who would like to see some of this money going to the rural areas. John Burnett has a report on the money that Cuban Americans have been sending back home to Cuba. That transfer of funds, of course, will now be stopping. And we'll begin a series on California coming out of recession, even if the entire state doesn't know it yet. And Michael Sullivan reports on the effects of the embargo against Haiti.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Peter Davison is poetry editor of the Atlantic Monthly, as well as a distinguished poet himself. When he was just beginning his career in the 1950s in Boston, Davison had the good luck to find himself in the midst of a creative community filled with young and gifted poets, among them Sylvia Plath, with whom he had a brief romance. Davison has just written a critical memoir of those times, titled The Fading Smile. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Paris in the 1920s, New York in the 50s, Woodstock in 69 and 94. Somehow I've never managed to be in any of these right places at the right times. Now, after reading The Fading Smile, I've added another missed golden moment to my list, Boston from 1955 to 1960. According to Peter Davison, the shining city on the hill was once a veritable Mount Parnassus. Walk around Harvard Square, and you could bump into Robert Bly and a woman friend, double dating with Donald Hall and Adrian Rich. Stumble into most any cocktail party, and it's likely you'd find a poetry jam starring such sozzled versifiers as Ted Hughes, Maxine Cumin, Richard Wilbur, and W.S. Merwin. The way Davison evokes the literary life he witnessed in Boston during the 50s could be summed up in those immortal lines by William Wordsworth, one of the few poets not on the scene then. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. The Fading Smile is a group portrait of some now famous poets who were based in Boston during the late 50s, a time when they were either just beginning their careers or gaining their full reputations. Davison can't explain this strange harmonic convergence in Boston back then, except to note that the grizzled presence of Robert Frost was a draw, as was Robert Lowell, who taught a poetry seminar at Boston University. Both Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton were in that seminar, after which, as Sexton wittily recalled, they'd sometimes drive to the Ritz-Carlton, park in the hotel loading zone, and go into the bar to load up on martinis. Davison offers some rigorous critiques of the poetry produced by his fellow Boston bards, but as that cocktail clatch anecdote suggests, the naughty appeal of a book like this is the way it mixes discussions of poetic scansion with poetic scandal. We hear, for instance, about a nightmarish party at Lowell's house, where W.S. Merwin kept pestering him with the question, "What do you really think of my work?" until Lowell finally answered, "I think you're a very, very good second-rate poet." When the subject of 1950s American poetry comes up, you usually hear about the Beats, so Davison helpfully reminds us of the East Coast poetic renaissance going on then. He also implicitly reminds us of what an old boys' club poetry used to be. Audrey and Rich had to sneak into the men-only Harvard poetry room, and Frost and Lowell were pretty dismissive of their women students. Davison's own opinions sometimes reflect the genteel sexism of the times that formed him. He's a bit too willing, for my taste, to resort to that old dodge of blaming poets' wives for their creative problems. And while we learn that Sylvia Plath resented Audrey and Rich, who in turn felt threatened by Anne Sexton, we don't hear much about similar poetic catfights among the boys. The Fading Smile is a lively, substantive account of what Davison calls one of the most exciting poetic surges ever to take place in America. But it also inadvertently lets you experience the sexist undertow that Plath and company had to battle.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Fading Smile by Peter Davison. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Jewel Bracey and Kathy Wolf. Abby Beshkin is our intern. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet singers Etta James and Martha Reeves. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.